For more presentations like this, visit www.xenos.org.
If you've got a Bible with you, you can open it to Acts chapter 12. And there's a story here about Peter, who's a character who's come up a lot, and also Herod, who in a lot of ways is kind of the main character in the story, which is kind of surprising, but I think he is. Anyway, let's jump right in. If you're just joining us for this study, Acts is a narrative book, so it tells a story, and it tells the story of what happened after Jesus Christ came as a man and did his ministry and was crucified and resurrected. What happened after that? How did that turn into where we are now? You know, what did God do next in his plan? And the answer is that God had a plan for what he was going to do next on the immediate heels of what he did through Jesus, and that he's going to work through people, ordinary people like you and I, which we call the church. And so Acts is really the story of the community of followers of Christ, the church, carrying out Jesus Christ's mission, which has to do with a message that we call the gospel, the good news, the gospel. And that is the announcement, the message that Jesus Christ has paved the way for anyone to be right with God, that he has done the heavy lifting, that he has paid for the guilt of our sins completely, past, present, future, and that he is inviting us to come and return to him and be forgiven and be made right with God. And that's what Acts is all about, is the transmission of that message out across the world in three stages. Jesus said, you're gonna be witnesses of that message in Jerusalem, the city where they were, and then next it's going to radiate out to Judea and Samaria, that's phase two, and then ambitiously from there to the remotest parts of the earth, that's phase three. And we've been kind of studying through phase two. We've been in Judea and Samaria, and last time we studied, out in those regions, an incredible thing happened, which was that a Gentile, a non-Jewish person, heard the gospel and received Christ and his whole family. And that's like a monumental, that's a milestone in the progress of the gospel, because it means that what Christ did on the cross isn't just for one group of people or another or one kind of person or another. It's for every single person in the entire world. And so the stage is set now for phase three, right? It's every man, woman, and child is fair game for the gospel. And God's like, I'm going out to the world. But interestingly, before that happens, Acts kind of takes a detour. And in chapter 12, the attention shifts back to Jerusalem, where we were for phase one. Because God's not done working in Jerusalem. He's faithfully working in all these places. And so Luke, chronologically telling our story, takes us back to Jerusalem for something else important that happens. Let's read. Acts 12, verse 1, it says, now about that time, Herod the king laid hands on some who belonged to the church in order to mistreat them. And he had James, the brother of John, put to death with a sword. So we're reading about this dude, Herod the king. And then when you're reading the Bible, anytime it talks about Herod, you've got to ask the question, which Herod are we talking about? Because there's a whole bunch of Herods. It's at least four by my count. Are we talking about Herod the Great? That's like the most famous. That's the guy who built, expanded the temple and did all these incredible building projects. That's who was king when Jesus was born. Not him. Not the next Herod that was Herod Antipas. That's the Herod who was king when Jesus died. But now we're a few years beyond that. We're dealing with Herod Agrippa the First. King Herod Agrippa the First. We know that he ruled in Israel from about 41 to 44 AD. So just this little window of time. It's kind of cool because it lets us know right where we are in history. You know, we're in 41, 42, 43 AD. There's a fourth Herod, King Herod Agrippa II, that comes up later in Acts. Paul deals with him later. But for now, it's this guy, King Herod Agrippa. And we read that he laid hands on some who belonged to the church in order to mistreat them. So there's already a pretty severe persecution happening, and King Herod jumps on the bandwagon. He's like, oh, we're beating up on Christians? I'm into that. And so he had James, the brother of John, put to death with a sword, which is an idiom. It means he had him beheaded, which was a way that they executed people. That's a big deal. James, the brother of John. That's not a nobody. James, the brother of John, is one of the 12. He's actually one of the three guys that kind of made Jesus' inner circle, James, John, and Peter. He's a big deal. And this is a sort of gruesome landmark as well, because this is the first of the 12 who dies in the name of Christ. And think about how terrifying that would have been. You know, that's a setback. That's a real blow to the church. But not only that, it's kind of an ominous development in the persecution, because if James can be killed, then anyone can be killed. When he saw that it pleased the Jews, he proceeded to arrest Peter also. So Herod's like, oh, look at all the Pharisees, and they love that. I got to get me somebody else. And so they go and arrest Peter. Peter, who's like the leader of the movement. Peter is like the man, right? Jesus said, on this rock I will build my church. He gets Peter. He's like, if you guys liked it when I killed James, you're going to love this. And when he had seized him, he put him in prison, delivering him to four squads of soldiers to guard him. The prison almost certainly would be the Antonia Fortress, which would have been built by his grandfather, Herod the Great. This is a model of the Herod's temple. And on the side, he built this massive fortress called the Antonia Fortress. He built it for Rome. All of these kings, yes, they're kings of Israel, but they're servile to Rome. All right, Rome has conquered Israel, and these kings have been put in power by the Roman emperors. They're client kings. They're puppets. They're sympathizers with Rome, and they kiss up to Rome. And so the Antonia Fortress, it's named after Mark Antony. It is the Roman garrison in Jerusalem. There's a cohort of Roman soldiers there. This is where, you know, Rome has control over Jerusalem from this fortress, which was largely considered impenetrable. And it's also where they housed prisoners. It says they had four squads of soldiers. That's a lot. A squad is four. So four squads would be 16 soldiers, probably rotating in shifts. He had four soldiers on him at all times. We'll read later, he had two chains. He was chained to one guard on one side and chained to another guard on the other side, and then two other guards to watch over that. That is like heavy-duty security, all right? That's like Magneto when they put him in the plastic prison, you know? Like, they do not want him to get away. And actually, it's warranted, because if you think about it, Peter is a high-profile prisoner. Peter is the leader of the movement that is sweeping the nation. He is a prize showpiece of the king. And, you know, he's got a history of inexplicable prison escapes, too, in Acts. And so they're, like, going to keep eight eyes on him at all times. It says, intending after the Passover to bring him out before the people. So here's the plan. Herod is hanging on to him. He's got his little prize here, and he's going to wait until Passover, when the city is jam-packed with pilgrims from all over. That's the big moment there in the city every year. On the big day of the year, we're going to wheel him out in public and execute him. Herod had executed others publicly for the purposes of entertainment before. He's going to make a show of it. This is bad, all right? This is a bad situation. Like, Herod in this passage is depicted as this ominous, this like unstoppable force, right? He's maniacal. He is menacing. He is like best friends with the emperor. He has unrestricted military power and wealth. And he has the church square in his crosshairs. He's already killed James, and now he has Peter, and there's nothing anyone can do. You know, I think it's important to build this up, because when we read these passages, we tend to just like read through real quick, like, okay, well, what happens next? And I think we get desensitized to the drama. There's a lot of drama here. Like, we know all the spoilers that Peter lives after this. Sorry, I just spoiled it. Peter lives. But, you know, you read this and you're like, you know, they didn't know that. Peter didn't know that he was going to live. The church didn't know that. In fact, what are the odds of Peter surviving this situation? It's like zero. What is the scenario in which Peter comes out of this alive? So Peter was kept in the prison, but prayer for him was being made fervently by the church to God. So the whole passage then hinges right here. Now we introduce the church. Peter was held in the prison, but prayer was being made fervently by the church. That's really all they can do. They have no recourse against this tyrant king. All they can do is pray. And I don't know what they were praying for. You know, Herod was crazy. Maybe they're praying that he changed his mind. Probably they're praying for a swift death instead of a long, tortuous death. I'm sure they were praying for Peter's family. And I'm sure they were praying for the church. You know, we're about to lose our leader. We'll be down to 10 apostles and only one of the three, you know. Who's going to replace them? And I'm sure they were asking God, like, what does this even mean? Are you even with us anymore? Our leaders are being killed. Did we do something wrong? Have you abandoned us? I'm sure it was pretty desperate. On the very night when Herod was about to bring him forward, Peter was sleeping between two soldiers, bound with two chains, and guards in front of the door were watching over the prison. So Peter's asleep. He's come to peace, I guess. He's made his peace with what's going to happen. And behold, an angel of the Lord suddenly appeared, and a light shone in the cell. And he struck Peter's side and woke him up, saying, "Get up quickly!" And his chains fell off his hands. I think Peter was a deep sleeper, you know? Like, he's always sleeping. He's asleep in the Garden of Gethsemane. Just last time we studied, he fell asleep on the roof of Simon the Tanner's house at lunchtime. That dude can sleep. And usually in the Bible, when an angel appears in light, people are like terrified. They go down on their face and they're like, "It's God!" You know, and they're trembling and they're terrifying. He's like asleep, and it's the angel has to be like, "Wake up!" You know, this picture, like, he appears like, "Behold, an angel of the Lord!" Oh, you got to be kidding me, dude! Wake up! "Behold, I'm here to rescue you." And the angel said, "Gird yourself and put on your sandals, get dressed." And he did so. And he said, "Wrap your cloak around you and follow me." And he went out and continued to follow. And he did not know that what was being done by the angel was real. But he thought he was seeing a vision. He's like, "This is just a dream." And when they had passed the first and the second guard, and they came to the iron gate that leads into the city, that's the gate of the fortress, that's the primary defense, that's meant to repel an invading army, it opened for them by itself. Like, you know, when you go to Kroger, and the door just... And they went out, and they went along one street, and immediately the angel departed. Whoosh. And Peter just found himself standing there. When Peter came to himself, he said, "Now I know for sure that the Lord has sent forth his angel and rescued me from the hand of Herod." God rescued me from Herod. And from all that the Jewish people were expecting, the show. And when he realized this, he went to the house of Mary, the mother of John, who was also called Mark, where many were gathered together and were praying. So he goes over to John Mark's house. That was an associate of Peter. John Mark's mom is named Mary, like everybody else in the first century, as far as I can tell. And it says there were many gathered together and were praying. Remember, the church in Jerusalem met in homes. So it's probably a home group. And they're praying. They're gathered together for the purpose of prayer. That's why they're there. And it's the middle of the night. So this is a vigil. When he knocked at the door of the gate, a servant girl named Rhoda came to answer. And when she recognized Peter's voice, because of her joy, she did not open the gate, but ran in and announced Peter was standing in front of the gate. So he's like, you know, "Hey, let me in." "Who is it?" "Rhoda, open up. It's me, Peter, you know?" The Rock? And she recognized his voice, but because of her joy, she just runs in and says, Peter's at the gate. And they said to her, you're out of your mind. They're like, oh no, Rhoda's finally lost it in her grief. She's had a break with reality. Poor foolish Rhoda. But she kept insisting that it was so. You can just picture him like, Rhoda, we're trying to pray, come on. So they kept saying, it is his angel. It is his angel, meaning like, it's his ghost. Like, it's the spirit of Peter. God has sent the spirit of Peter. That means, oh God, that means Peter's dead. They killed him. Oh God, why, Peter? Meanwhile, Peter continued knocking. And when they had opened the door, they saw him and were amazed. They were amazed. I mean, on the one hand, that makes perfect sense. It's totally amazing. But you catch the irony in this passage, right? They're praying. And then they're amazed that Peter is there. It was easier for them to believe that Rhoda had lost it than that God had answered their prayer. It was easy to believe that a ghost had appeared than it was to believe that God would actually answer their prayer. It's like they weren't expecting for God to answer it. And I think that there's a lesson there about prayer that, I actually find that really encouraging. Have you ever thought to yourself, maybe God's not answering my prayer because I don't have enough faith? Or maybe someone said to you, if you really believed it, God would answer. Have you ever heard anyone say something like that? Well, that's not really how the Bible thinks about prayer, is it? How much faith did they have that he was going to answer their prayer? Not that much. How much faith do we need in order for God to answer one of our prayers? How much faith do you have to bring to the table? The answer is just enough faith to open your mouth and pray, according to this passage. And that's how faith works. Faith isn't like a commodity that we bring, and if we have enough, we'll persuade God to cough up a blessing. God's not stingy like that, and that's not how faith works. Faith is when we believe what God says enough to act. And Jesus says, they're like, how much faith do we need? He says, you need a mustard seed of faith. That's like the smallest thing you can imagine, a mustard seed. That's how much faith you need. And I think it's important because it holds true in a lot of our dealings with God. It holds true, for example, in the question of how do I come to God in the first place if I'm far from him? How much faith do you need to be made right with God? You need enough faith to know the whole Bible and read it and believe every word? And do you need enough faith to change your life and change your heart and think differently? Do you need enough faith to initiate with God and persuade God to take you in? No. The Bible is really clear. You need enough faith to call out to him for help. Just enough. But motioning to them with his hand to be silent, he described to them how the Lord had led him out of the prison, and he said, report these things to James and the brethren. The other James, who had sort of become the de facto leader there in Jerusalem, report these things to the church. Then he left and went to another place. Now, when day came, there was no small disturbance among the soldiers as to what could have become of Peter. I bet that was quite a scene. When Herod had searched for him and not found him, he examined the guards and ordered that they be led away to execution. Whoa. He killed all 16 guards, or at least 4. That's because, for Peter to escape that situation, that meant that the guards were either in on it or just grossly negligent in their duty. It's one or the other. And that was how it worked in Rome. If a guard or jailer lost a prisoner, the punishment was you get what that prisoner was going to get. And so Herod has them executed. I think Luke is reminding us that Herod is not that nice of a dude. Then he went from Judea to Caesarea and was spending time there. Now, I think this is interesting because don't you feel like the story is over? And yet the story keeps going, like Peter's been released, and now the story follows Herod. And it says, so the next thing is Herod went from Judea down to Caesarea. That's the city we were in last time we studied. That's like that's the real Roman capital there. That's where the real Roman military presence is. Herod would have had a sprawling palace. He's going back to his home base. And it keeps telling us what Herod did next. It said now, when he was very angry with the people of Tyre and Sidon, and with one accord they came to him, having won over Blastus, the king's chamberlain, and they were asking for peace because their country was fed by the king's country. So the political drama of the moment was King Herod was in a feud with Tyre and Sidon, which were the regions right to the north. And the problem is he feeds them, and so either he has refused to feed them and cut them off, or he's threatening to cut them off. And so their leaders have come down to Caesarea and begged to get an audience with the king because they want to come and plead for mercy and grovel before the king so that he'll feed them. And it says, on an appointed day, Herod, having put on his royal apparel, took his seat on the rostrum and began delivering an address to them. So Herod calls a giant meeting. He says, all right, you want to talk to me? Let's talk. And he puts on his finest robes. Herod liked to give his speeches in the theater, which was right there. It's still there, right to the south of Caesarea. And so he calls this giant meeting, and they bring in all these leaders. It's like a summit, and they're going to grovel, and he's going to be the king. And I love this. It says he puts on his royal apparel, and he took his seat. He's going to address them from the throne. I'm going to sit on my throne and give a speech while you beg for mercy, because I'm the king. There's a power trip here. And the people kept crying out, the voice of a god and not of a man. So these people here before Herod, what they're doing is they're worshiping him as a god. They're saying, when you speak, it is divine. It is the words of a god, not a man. Not something that would ever happen in our culture. But in Roman culture, that did happen. It was cool to worship Caesar as a god. Now, Caesar didn't like it when other people were worshipped as a god or put themselves up as a god. That was not cool. But that's what's happening. They're like, you're our god. And immediately, an angel of the Lord struck him because he did not give God the glory, and he was eaten by worms and died. Whoa, what? This has got to be the most unexpected verse in the entire book. You're reading along, you're like, okay, where is this going? And then he died. It's like, what? Did not see that coming. What is happening in this verse? Okay, they're worshiping him as a god. He didn't give God the glory. So he's like, yeah, like, yes, I am a god. He is affirming their worship. And then an angel of the Lord struck him, and he was eaten by worms and died. This is a weird verse. This is a weird verse. It's sudden, for one thing. You know, like, you almost get the feeling it's like a kid in creative writing class who's, like, writing a story, and he realizes the bell's going to ring in 10 seconds. He's like, he was eaten by worms and died. The end. You know? It's such a weird ending. It's also really gross. You know? Luke is like this elegant writer. Luke's writing a legal brief. He's interviewing eyewitnesses and putting it in consecutive order and adding in all these historical references. He's recording inspired speeches that are beautiful. Luke is writing the word of God. And then he's like, yeah, worms, you know, and died. It's just, it's weird, is what it is. And what does it even mean, by the way? Shouldn't it be like he died and then was eaten by worms? It's got to be fiction. You know, you get to a point like this in a passage and you're like, I'm reading a myth here. You know, I'm reading a legend. There's no way that this was real. If only we could know what really happened. You know, if only we had like an actual historical resource, not a spiritual book that has all kinds of fluff, but if only we had a concrete, historical, primary resource, something that actually told us what really happened, then we could understand. And, as it turns out, we do. This same event was recorded by Flavius Josephus. Now, Josephus was a first century Roman historian. He was a first century Jew who was a sympathizer with the invading Romans, and actually he eventually fully defected over, became buddies with Emperor Vespasian's son, and became his personal translator, and later in his life became an official Roman historian and wrote annals for the library. And these were Roman works. They're from a Roman perspective. He wrote the Antiquities of the Jews and the Jewish War. And these are secular works, okay? They're not... Josephus was not a Christian. Josephus hated Christians. These histories are the kind of primary resources that modern historians use to... Like, this is how we know what happened in those times, is that we have these official histories. So this is a reliable primary resource. Let's read what he wrote when he wrote about Herod Agrippa and his death. It's actually really fascinating. And I think not only does it shed light on what Luke wrote, it also lends credibility to what Luke wrote. It's clearly different, as you can see. It's independent. Let's read it. It says, "Now when Agrippa had reigned 3 years over all Judea, he came to the city of Caesarea. A great multitude was gotten together of the principal persons and such as were of dignity through his province. On the second day, he put on a garment made wholly of silver and a contexture truly wonderful." So he too is noting he was wearing very special clothes. "And came into the theater early in the morning, at which time the silver of his garment," so it's woven with real silver, "at which time the silver of his garment being illuminated by the fresh reflection of the sun's rays upon it, shone out in a surprising manner and was so resplendent as to spread a horror over those who looked intently upon him. And presently his flatterers cried out, one from one place and another from another, though not for his good, that he was a god. And they added, be thou merciful to us, for although we have hitherto reverenced thee only as a man, yet shall we henceforth own thee as superior to mortal nature." They worshipped him as a god, just like Luke said, because of his clothes. "Upon this, the king did neither rebuke them nor reject their impious flattery. But as he presently afterward looked up, a severe pain also arose in his belly and began in a most violent manner." He has a digestive issue. "Accordingly, he was carried into the palace," so carried off the stage mid-speech, "and the rumor went abroad everywhere that he would certainly die in a little time. All places were also full of mourning and lamentation. Now the king rested in a high chamber, and as he saw them below lying prostrate on the ground, he could not himself forbear weeping. And when he had been quite worn out by the pain in his belly for 5 days, he departed this life." What? He died of some kind of like parasitic... He was eaten by worms and died. This is faith building for me. You know, I read this and I'm like, here's one of the most unbelievable and hard to understand passages in the entire book. You read it and you're like, I can't believe that. And then here is a concrete primary resource, both agreeing with and corroborating Luke's history. That's why a book like the Book of Acts holds up and is itself too regarded as solid history by modern historians, that Luke's historical points stand up, and believe me, no book has ever been scrutinized like the Bible. It's one of the really important things about Acts. We're not reading a myth. We are reading events. We're reading history. "But the word of the Lord continued to grow and to be multiplied." And here's now where the story ends, and it ends with one of Luke's checkpoints, one of his references on the main plot of the book. So all this happened, and what was the result? The word of the Lord continued to grow, which means that the church was growing and that the message of the gospel was spreading out. God's plan advanced. I think that's really interesting that the story ends here and not with Peter's escape. What, you know, what is Luke presenting us here? He's presenting us with a power struggle. Here was this king. Here's this unstoppable force with his fancy, you know, garments and with his military might and with all his money and rich friends, and no one could stop him. And then, you know, escalated to the point that it's like, he's like a god. He was a god, but he wasn't a god. And he had 5 days to lay there and contemplate the fact of his mortality before he died. He was not a god. There is one god, and a dude like Herod is no match. It's a story of reversal, where at the beginning of the story, it's Peter who faces certain death. Peter's doomed. Peter's a dead man walking. And yet, who dies? Herod. It is a defeat of an enemy. It's not even put out there like coincidentally, ironically, Herod died. It's more deliberate than that. Did you catch what it said? It said an angel of the Lord struck him. Like God did it. Here was this unstoppable enemy and God took him out. That is a picture of a victorious God triumphing over his enemies who would oppose him. God defeats his enemies. I actually think that's Luke's point here. I think that's the point of this passage. And what was the church's role in that defeat? What did the people do? If you think about it, like, not that much. The church's role was super passive. Like, they didn't stage a jailbreak on Antonia Fortress. They did not send Peter a cake with a hacksaw baked into it. Like, they didn't do anything. They prayed. That's what it said. It said Peter was kept in prison, but prayer for him was being made fervently by the church. There's the two things in contrast. There's the juxtaposition. All these terrible, unstoppable circumstances, it's hopeless, but the church prayed. I think that's the theme statement of the chapter there. Everything was wrong, but the church prayed and God triumphed. Yeah, that's right. There's the turning point right there is prayer. Acts 12 is a battle and prayer is the hero. So I think it's a good question to ask then, what observations can we make? What does this passage tell us about prayer? Can we draw any conclusions that might help us when we think about prayer? One that's obvious is that prayer is powerful. Like, God moved, and God answered their prayers. Somehow, and I know this is mysterious, but somehow our prayers are associated with the manifestation of his power. God is totally in control, he is totally sovereign, and yet, for some weird reason, he's like, the way this is going to work is, my power comes out when you pray. He's not like, I'll handle the spiritual stuff and you handle the earthly stuff. He's like, no, I'm going to do a supernatural work through history and I'm going to do it through you, and it's going to happen. When it's going to be awesome is when there is agreement between you and I. When you and I agree, things are going to happen. When man and God gets on the same page, that's when my will is going to advance, and that's how I choose to work. For some reason, God has decided that his unlimited power will be bound up with our puny little prayers. And I don't know why he did it that way. I have no idea why it is that way. My theory is that it glorifies God, that it is a restoration of the created order, where, you know, what is mankind made for? To work as an extension of God, to keep and to cultivate the earth as stewards of God. We're built to be unified with God and work according to his will as an extension of him. And I think that it glorifies him to accomplish his will through us and through our agreement with him. That's what I think. So what that means is that when we pray, when you and God get on the same page about something, stuff's going to happen. And that theme is all through Acts. All the big moments in Acts are accompanied by prayer. You can't miss it. When does the Holy Spirit first come in Acts chapter 2? When the church prayed for a whole week. When did God reach the Gentiles last time we studied? When Peter and Cornelius went and prayed. When the church prays, things happen. And God answers prayers. Do you believe that? Like, do you actually believe it? I mean, you know that the right answer is yes, of course, God answers prayers. But do you believe that in your life, that God answers prayers? What are the things you're really worried about in your life right now? What are the curveballs that God's thrown in your life? What are the things that are keeping you up at night? And now let me ask you a question that's going to sound condescending, but I don't mean it condescending. Have you prayed about those things? You're like, of course I've prayed about it. But have you actually? It amazes me how often I go through life and I don't pray about the things that I actually care about. And then I do not have because I do not ask. God's not stingy, and he loves to give us good things. Ask and it will be given to you, he says in Luke 11. Seek and you will find. Knock and the door will be opened to you. For everyone who asks receives. And the one who seeks finds. And to the one who knocks, the door will be open. Or how about John 16:23? Jesus says, truly I say to you, if you ask the Father for anything in my name, he will give it to you. The New Testament has these epic promises about prayer like this. God intends to answer your prayers. Sometimes in amazing and obvious ways. Sometimes in surprising ways. Like they were surprised the way that God answered their prayer that day. Because God is surprising. Sometimes he's so surprising that we miss the answer altogether, right? Sometimes his answers are hard for us to recognize. That's because, like, if you're like me, my prayers tend to sound like directions to God. You know, where I like to instruct God how he ought to solve my problems. So I'll be like, you know, here's this thing, and oh, shoot, we don't have enough money for this thing. And so I go to God, and I say, God, help us with our money problem. I pray that this would happen, and then this, and then this, and this, and this, which would allow for that to happen, and then we'd have a lot of cash, and the problem would be solved. I pray for that. As though God needs my advice. As though God's up there like, I'm sorry, I can't solve it, you know. Oh, well, actually, now that you mention it, that's a good idea. I hadn't thought of that then. Brilliant, I'll do that. And then when God doesn't answer in all the ways that I stipulated for him, I sit back and I'm like, didn't answer my prayer. And God's like, yeah, actually, I hear your prayer. You want help with your money problem, and if I give you a handful of cash, that's not going to help your money problem. That's just going to lead you to the next money problem. So I'll help you with your money problem in a way that I know will actually help. Maybe I'll put someone in your life who actually gets money and can help you actually make a budget and be a responsible adult and become a steward of God, of God's money, so that you can be used more powerfully in your life in the long run. And maybe in the short run, I'll let you feel the squeeze so you actually have a teachable heart long enough to change. What I find is a lot of times when God answers my prayers in unexpected ways, the way that he answered was way better than the way that I had in mind, even if it wasn't exactly what I wanted. Sometimes he answers, but his timing is not our timing. I make lots of requests to God, and most of them have an implied suffix on the end, which is the words, right now. You know, God, I pray for this, right now. It would be cool if you did this, immediately. And God's like, I'm outside of time, and I know the right time for things, and I will answer your prayer, but not now. God answers prayers, and sometimes the answer is no. I bet they prayed for James when he got locked up by Herod. They had to have had prayer vigils for James. I'm sure Peter himself prayed for James. And yet, for whatever mysterious reason, God in his wisdom allowed James to die. And I don't know why. But what happens is when God answers no, sometimes we get our faith shattered by that, and we're disturbed by that, and we go on strike from prayer. And see, the problem is we're thinking of God in the wrong way. We're thinking of God like a vending machine, and I put in my prayer money, and this stupid thing ate my dollar. It doesn't work. And God's like, yeah, well, this is a relationship. yes, I will give you anything you ask for in my name. You're accessing my power for my will. I'm not a genie. All right? It's that you and I are agreeing on what needs to happen in the redemption of this world. And when that happens, my power is unleashed. Sometimes the answer is no. Maybe our prayers are not in line with his will. A lot of times our prayers, however sincere, are really not that good of ideas. Like looking back over my life, there are certain prayers that I was really mad God didn't answer, and I look back now and I'm like, thank God he didn't answer that prayer. That was so loving that he said no. My kids think I'm a tyrant because I will not let them go down the slide on their roller skates. And I'm like, I'm sorry, I know you think I'm heartless and I don't want you to have any fun, but like some of your ideas are stupid, I'm sorry. And guys, so are some of yours. I hate to tell you, God's like, look, no, trust me, you'll thank me later. Maybe our prayers are good, but he has a greater good in mind. A lot of times it's that. Those are the ones that frustrate us, where I'm like, I know this has got to be in your will. And he still says no. Why? Like my daughter the other day said, she called me up in the middle of the night. She'd had a nightmare. And she was angry. Dad, she said, I prayed that I wouldn't have any bad dreams, and I did. I pray every night that I wouldn't have bad dreams, and I did. There's a parent challenge for you right there. At 3 a.m, you're like, well, theologically, you know, like, what should she conclude from that? Should she conclude that God failed? I'm sorry, honey. He can protect you from some bad dreams, but he's just not strong enough to protect you from all. Maybe she should conclude that God doesn't care. He wanted you to have that bad dream. Well, what I think, the real conclusion there, what I conclude is that God hates bad dreams and he hates for little kids to suffer, but this is a fallen world that is alienated from God and doesn't work right. And part of this fallen world, one feature of this fallen world, are bad dreams. And that means that God is hard at work through human history to redeem that world, to rescue that world and do away with things like bad dreams forever and ever. And little Addie is a part of that plan. That she is to be an agent for his redemption of this world. And if she's going to work for him in this world, if she's going to be a light in this dark place, if she's going to be an instrument in the hand of God in a fallen world, then she's going to have to know how to deal with bad dreams. Would it even be loving for him to answer her prayer and take them all away? No, it wouldn't, actually. And that's important because here we are sitting here in this fallen world, and we have to have in mind that God is going to set all things right. God is going to get his way. Ultimately, God will make all right, but in the meantime, sometimes the answer is no. I think we can get from this passage that prayer is our go-to in trials. Here's this trial. What do? They're like, we got to pray. All-night prayer vigil right now. Is that your instinct when trials come? We got to pray? That's a good instinct to develop. My instinct is, I have to fix this. And then when I fail at fixing it, I'm like, God, and I pray in desperation. Wouldn't it be better if my instinct like them was to go and pray? Psalm 32:6, therefore let everyone who is godly pray to you in a time when you may be found. Surely in a flood of great waters they will not reach him. You are my hiding place. You preserve me from trouble. You surround me with songs of deliverance. What is life thrown at you today? You got to pray about that. Prayer is the rhythm of the Christian life. All through Acts we see, like in Acts 2:42, when he's describing the church, what are they doing? He says they were continually devoting themselves to the apostles' teaching and fellowship and the breaking of bread and to prayer. They were continually devoted. It was a daily part of their routine and their everyday life, and it was something that they did together. The church prayed together. And I think that's very important because it doesn't mean they never prayed alone. Peter and Cornelius were praying alone last week. But by and large, when the church is described in Acts, it is described as praying corporately. And that means so should we. I believe very strongly we should get together to pray. You should get together to pray with other people, is what I'm saying. And I know, I can read your mind. I know what you're thinking. You're like, yeah, I agree with that, Ben, but here's the thing. I'm really busy, and time isn't convenient for me when they pray, and I prefer solo prayer, and I get intimidated, and I don't like being confined to a certain time, and my voice sounds weird in public, and Jim's going to be there, and let's face it, Jim is annoying. I know, right? There's all these barriers and more. There's all these reasons not to do it. Just like every other good thing in life, there's all these barriers. Yep. But consider Matthew 18, 19. It says, if two of you agree on earth about anything that they may ask, it shall be done for them by my Father who is in heaven. For where two or three have gathered together in my name, I am there in their midst. Jesus is saying, yeah, but there is something special about Christians getting together to pray. I have a provision for you that you can only experience when you get together with other Christians to pray. And if you don't do that, you're missing out. You will be built up by their prayers, by hearing what they pray for and how they pray and what's on their heart and the things going on in their lives and the lives of others. You will be built up by hearing that, and they will be built up by your prayers. That's the mutuality in the body of Christ. And don't forget that second point, because so often we sit there and we're like, oh, it's time for prayer. Should I go or not? And we get up the mental pro-con list. And it's like, well, on the one hand, on the other hand. And what we usually leave off that pro-con list is how it might affect anyone else other than ourselves. We're asking the question, is prayer good for me right now, today? And has it occurred to you that the best reason for going and praying with others might not have anything to do with you at all? It might be because God wants to do something through your mouth in the lives of the other people in that room or beyond. This is an other-centered practice. So, here's my challenge. What next step does God have for you when it comes to corporate prayer? That's always the right question to ask, is not how do I become a master of this tomorrow? The question is, what's the next thing I can do? And maybe for you, it's the next step is to discover it. Maybe you've never experienced a corporate prayer meeting. Maybe you've never sat with others and heard their prayers and sensed the Spirit. You know, that word agree in Matthew 18 is symphoneo, like instruments in a symphony working together. You know, when someone prays for something and then you're like, yeah, and you add something to that, and then someone else adds to that, and you're like, I never thought about that. And when we come together and see that God answered that and we give thanks together, like, that's sweet. If you've never had that, you are totally missing out. I will never forget my first prayer meeting. I was totally depressed. I had dropped out of college. I was a complete wreck, and I had called up the one friend I knew who was in a Bible study and asked to come out, and I hung out with them, and I called him the next day and said, what are you guys doing tonight? You want to hang out? And he said, well, we have a prayer meeting. You probably wouldn't want to come to that. And I was so desperate, I was like, sure, I'll go to that. And I showed up to this prayer meeting, and they had a list of people and things they were praying for, and get this, my name was on their list. And it was because my mom was so worried about me, she had called up my one Christian friend and be like, please pray for my son. And they'd been praying for me for months. And they were embarrassed, like they were mortified that there was my name. But I thought it was awesome. Because by that point, I was convinced that God himself was already at work in my life. Like, I knew God was doing something. And when I saw that, I got chills because I was like, they don't even know it, but God's already answered these prayers. Holy cow, God's working here. So that was an easy sell for me. I was like, I'm in. I'll be back. This is doing something. Maybe It's that you need to rediscover it. Maybe that's the next step. I confess that my passion for corporate prayer has dropped off. I was working on this teaching, and I was like, man, I feel like a hypocrite getting up and saying how awesome this is because, you know, my home group has a prayer meeting, but I've been teaching here instead of where they are, and I haven't been going, and I'm out of the loop, and I haven't been thinking about it, and I don't think there's any sense beating ourselves up for that. If you're like me, you know, what I take from that is I'm probably due to rediscover how sweet it is. And maybe you're due for that too. Maybe you're ready for a season of prayer. Maybe the next step for you is to show up. You know, there was one dude who thought about going to that vigil and was like, no, never mind, and like just slept that night. And then the next day they're like, dude, Peter showed up. He's like, what? Don't be that dude. I'm sure it happened. Maybe your step is to speak up. That's a scary step of faith for a lot of people. That might be the step of faith of the year for you right there, to open your mouth. If you're sitting there wrestling with, I hate praying in front of other people, let me just encourage you that God made your mouth, and you're never going to regret taking a risk by opening it in His name, even if it's just a sentence. And maybe the next step for you is to step up, because prayer needs led. Someone's got to initiate prayer between you and your spouse. Someone's got to initiate prayer with your kids. Someone's got to get that prayer meeting before work going. Maybe your home church doesn't have a prayer meeting, or maybe your home church has a languishing prayer meeting. I believe that good prayer community needs cheerleaders. It needs gifted people who are passionate about prayer to take the flag and step up and be like, let's do this. And maybe that's you. We need that. So if you devote yourself to prayer, you should expect resistance, because your flesh will always hate prayer. It never ceases to. I always have resistance. I get lunch with a friend, and we have a good hangout, and we're about to go, and he's like, hey, you want to pray? There's always this part of me that's like, ooh, no, I want to go. That's always there. Expect that, but you should also expect to see God do amazing things, because we have a powerful God. So there's Acts chapter 12. All right, let's pray right now. Thank you for the privilege of being able to speak and ask of you, God. And just think about, you're a good king, you know. Herod was a king who they had to grovel for and pull strings to get an audience with, and he lorded it over them. You're like, come have an audience with me at all times. And I want to hear from you, and I want to agree with you. And it's pretty sweet. Thank you that we can do that anytime, and show us each the next step to fulfill that and to experience that, God. Amen.
This study was recorded at Xenos Christian Fellowship and is copyrighted. You may freely copy and distribute it as long as you keep it intact and do not sell it.